First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Duval County Schools standing firm against the state in working to protect teachers and kids from COVID-19. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this hour, the battle intensifies between Duval Schools and Florida's Education Commissioner. And what about vaccine checks for teachers who've gotten the shot? What's going on there? Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, don't miss my conversation with Anita Hill. Yes, that Anita Hill. About the Supreme Court, the Me Too movement, and the fight to end gender-based violence. We go inside the pages of her new book, Believing. But first this hour, Florida's education commissioner says he will dock Duval County Schools more money to balance out assistance from the federal government in the continuing battle of wills over masks in class. Commissioner Richard Corcoran sent memos Tuesday to the State Board of Education requesting that the state hold back both school board members' salaries and funds equal to the federal grants sent out to cover those losses. They were sent to 11 school districts, including Duval County. Now, the State Board of Education meets today. WJCT reporter Claire Heddles joins us now in studio with more about this and also why school employees in the city will not be getting any vaccine bonuses. Hey, Claire, good morning.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me back.
Good to have you. Already getting your calls, folks. 549-2937. Give us a call. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. So, Claire, lots to talk about when it comes to the school system, but let's begin with this ongoing skirmish between the state and Duval County. Duval County continues to defy the state with its mask mandate. It's not going to lift it until the case numbers go down a little more. Now we hear Richard Corcoran is trying to make sure the districts lose money. What's happening with this?
So Richard Corcoran has been threatening withholding school board member salaries since August. He first said that in August. He hasn't done so yet, but it's sort of this ongoing threat that if they don't lift their mask mandate, he's going to withhold those salaries. The Biden administration has been saying for months and has actually acted on it in Alachua County that we'll reimburse you for whatever the state holds back from you in enforcing mask mandates. Mm-hmm. Now, Richard Corcoran on Tuesday is asking the State Board of Education to hold back both school board member salaries and state funds equal to whatever amount a district gets from a federal grant related to this. So it's sort of become this convoluted, ever circling withdrawal of money.
Yeah.
To try to make sure this districts feel it.
Will the districts feel any financial pinch, though, given that the federal government is sending them money?
Well, that's sort of the question. How many times would this go round and round? I mean, if the federal government says, we'll fill it in, and then the state government says, okay, we'll take out your state funds, then will the federal government fill those in, and then the state takes it out again? So it's sort of a difficult threat to carry out, I think, especially since the federal government has said and followed through on the fact that they'll reimburse the districts for it.
Meanwhile, the Duval County Schools says they'll relax their mask mandate when the county has fewer than 50 cases per 100,000 people. As you report, Superintendent Diana Green says that may not happen until early next month. So potentially by next month, the masks could come off. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's one thing she laid out during the school board meeting on Tuesday was sort of what we've seen so far based on the trends, based on when cases per 100,000 sort of catches up to the percent positivity rate. And she said, based on those trends, we're expecting less than 50 cases per 100,000 by the first week of November. But there's been a lot of debate about whether that's a good measure to keep following. So they are planning to meet next week to reconsider that threshold if they want to keep the under 50 per 100,000 as the threshold for lifting the mandate.
We're checking in with WJCT reporter Claire Heddles on her reporting about the Duval County Public Schools, mask mandates, vaccine bonuses, and more. and the district's battle against the state. We'll go to your calls in a moment. Let us know your thoughts. 549-2937. The school board has looked into suing the state, but they haven't yet, right?
That's true. Yeah, they actually authorized their legal counsel to take legal action against the state. And so the attorneys could do that at any point. They haven't yet. That might come after the state actually withholds some funds. They might be waiting for there to be some physical harm done that they can show in a legal case. So it's possible that that will come after the State Board of Education meets today. But we haven't seen a case filed yet by the school district.
Yeah, the State Board of Education is meeting today. So we could see some more news come out of that. But, you know, Claire, it is remarkable to see this ongoing battle between large urban school districts across Florida and some smaller ones, too. And the state, the education commissioner and the governor, this is really extraordinary to see this happen in this way. When you talk to parents, teachers, school board members, do they feel this same sense of bizarreness that we are seeing this actually play out in real time?
Definitely. And Duval is in good company. As you said, there's 10 other school districts that are also defying the state. And at this point, more students in the state are under a mask mandate than aren't under a mask mandate. So it's actually most students that are under a mask mandate that the state is fighting against. And so I think there definitely is this disconnect between what so many students are under and what the state is continuing trying to force. And I think there's also maybe a sense among some parents of this sort of distracting from other things that matter, that this ongoing legal battle over masks and debate over masks, it takes up so much time that focusing on improving education and mm-hmm. school lunches and other sorts of issues that are important.
Give us a call, folks, as we talk about the next phase of Claire's reporting. There was an attempt at the school board meeting to give vaccinated school employees $200 and an extra week off. It was shot down in a tied vote, 3-3, by the school board. Part of the reason for that is board member Elizabeth Anderson had to be absent, and due to census changes, they were unable to vote this through. Basically, though, what they were looking to do was give a vaccine bonus to people who had gotten vaccinated. That is something a lot of companies are looking at doing, not just the Duval County Public Schools, right?
It's true. A lot of companies are doing that. And Duval County Public Schools already has one vaccine bonus. This would actually have been an additional vaccine bonus. Last month at the September school board meeting, they authorized a $200 credit to go towards health plans. So it could be a discount on your health insurance or towards your benefits. And that was for school employees and if they were vaccinated. So there have mm-hmm. already been some vaccine incentives. This would have been an additional $200 direct check to vaccinated employees and this extra week of emergency leave. Now, they only could have used that if they tested positive for COVID. It was like emergency COVID leave.
Mm-hmm.
But
it did seem, though, like an attempt to incentivize teachers, the majority of whom are vaccinated anyway. As you report, Claire, school board chair Diana Green said this week, 10 teachers in the city have died from COVID in just the past 3 months. She said between paid leave last year and paying for medical expenses, the district has spent millions in trying to cover costs associated with this pandemic, which is really eye-popping.
Yeah, that was one of the things that the school board members opposing the incentives were talking about. They're saying this is a waste of $2 million. Why are we just handing out checks? And what Superintendent Green says is we've already spent $10 million on healthcare, paid leave, and hospitalizations for teachers that have gotten COVID between last year and this year. And so $2 million is actually a drop in the bucket of the cost of people being hospitalized for this disease.
We're talking with reporter Claire Heddles about vaccine bonuses, masks in schools, the state's battle with districts like Duval County. How is federal money being sent to school districts going to be spent? 549-2937. Kendra in Mandarin. Hi, Kendra. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. I'd like to say that I am absolutely in favor of incentivizing teachers getting vaccinated. Teachers receive incentives all the time on a merit-based system, which is also called performance pay. I know that when I worked at a turnaround school in Duval County Public Schools, I received a $3,500 sign-on bonus to commit to staying at that turnaround school for 3 years. And even though I didn't accept it, I was also offered about $1,500 to stay another 2 years, but I actually moved to a different school. So I just wanted to say that we incentivize performance and sticking with turnaround schools with monetary incentives all the time. We also require vaccinations for students. So this is nothing new. It would just be an additional incentive. Thank you.
Yeah, Kendra, thanks. Claire, do you think they might take this matter up again?
I'm not sure if they'll take it up again. I mean, I think that's a great point that there are a lot of incentives in the district. And another thing that the school board members supporting the measure said is that all these unions agreed to it. And I speak to one of the union representatives, and he said he sent the proposal to all of his union members, and he didn't have a single negative comment about it. Everyone, even those that were unvaccinated, signed on to it because it did have a benefit both for unvaccinated and vaccinated populations. It had the $200 check and the extra week off for vaccinated employees, and it would have given all other employees another 24 hours off of emergency paid COVID leave. So it actually had a benefit for all employees, regardless of whether they got vaccinated. But this particular memorandum, I think, is unlikely to come back up. They may consider another incentive, but probably not in this direct check kind of way.
549-2937, Ron in Mandarin. Hi, Ron.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I have a comment. This governor is against mandates on masks, and children are going to school, getting COVID, going home, getting to the hospital, dying. Why hasn't somebody told the governor he's murdering children?
The governor would disagree with that, Ron. Thank you for your call. Claire Heddles, this gets at the heart of our political divide right now over how to respond to this pandemic. Whether you believe in the governor's stance giving parents the right to decide whether their kids wear a mask, and whether you believe that universal mask wearing won't do a lot to limit the spread of COVID-19 in schools. By the way, that's not true. The data is in that universal mask wearing does limit the spread of COVID-19. Or whether you agree with the protocols that school districts are taking, even though kids are less likely to get seriously ill and die from this disease, far less likely than adults, there are still some kids who are getting sick and are ending up in ICUs. Yes, it's a minority of children, but it's still enough children that these districts are taking the risk of defying the state over this matter.
And there's children, of course, that live with family members that are immunocompromised or that are older, that are particularly susceptible to COVID. And I would also say, beyond just the battle of wills over COVID and masks, one thing that has come up repeatedly is that this is a battle over local control. And I think that's a large part of what the school board has been saying, especially those that are in favor of defying the governor, saying that this isn't just about masks, this is about setting a precedent for the future, that when we vote, we make a decision as a school board for our community, that actually stands, that the governor can't come in and overturn it, sort of based on whatever he wants in the moment.
Lots of tweets, and you can also call the show at 549-2937. People have questions about the decision as to when they might end the mask mandate. Here's a tweet from Ann. Is that 50 cases per 100,000 students or 50 cases per 100,000 people in all of Duval County? Neither makes any sense. Elementary kids under age 12 still don't have access to a vaccine. Cases will explode if they don't wear masks.
So it's countywide. So they're basing it on Duval County Health Department's measures for moderate transmission. So they said they'll lift the mandate when we reach a countywide moderate transmission level. And there's actually two factors that play into that moderate transmission level. One is the under 8% testing positivity rate, which we did reach last week at 7.3%. And then the second is the less than 50 cases per 100,000 countywide.
And people are wondering, too, about the money that the state says it will withhold from schools. So let's talk about that a little more. For people who are confused about this, the state is trying to withhold the salaries of educators who are defying them on masks. At the same time, we learned this week that Florida is the only state in the nation that has not applied to draw down billions in federal funding for schools, COVID relief for schools under the American Rescue Plan. There's a lot of news around money, and this is taxpayer money, let's be clear, that is supposed to be going to schools, kids, and educators. We really, as you mentioned a minute ago, Claire, we don't know yet how the situation's going to shake out between the state trying to withhold money and the feds trying to send districts money. But what about this other matter, that Florida hasn't even applied for billions of dollars in funding, the only state that hasn't tried to draw down this funding, and they haven't spent most of what they already have gotten from the federal government? Do we know why?
Well, Governor DeSantis's reasoning, what he said, was that the schools haven't asked for it, which I think a lot of school districts and school board members have been up in arms about, that it's not that we couldn't use the money, it's that maybe there weren't the pathways to request it or to apply for these funds. But that's what the governor said, was that the districts haven't asked for this money. In terms of the specific money that would be withheld over the mask mandate, we calculated what that would be for school board member salaries. Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran says it'll be on a monthly basis, so it'll be 1 month's worth of school board member salaries. In Duval County, that's $22,000. So the state might withhold $22,000, then the federal government presumably would step in and give us $22,000, and then the state is now saying we would withhold $22,000 of our funds to you in another pot to make sure that you still feel that $22,000.
Okay. You know, this is something that, let me ask you this. For people who don't have kids in the Duval County Public Schools, why should they care about this? Let's talk about that.
Well, definitely COVID itself spreading in schools makes a difference for everyone in the community. And I think that's one thing that has come up a lot in the mask mandate debate, is that even if kids don't get really sick, even if they can recover, they still live in a community with people that can't necessarily recover and that might get really sick. And so what happens in schools impacts everyone who lives in a community that has schools in it.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing that can be hard sometimes to translate to folks. It's 549-2937 now. You'll be following the State Board of Education meeting today. This should be really interesting because it's gotten so acrimonious and so bitter between the state and these 11 school districts, including Duval County. Do we have any idea of what the Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran might say or do today?
So the memos that Corcoran filed to the State Board of Education that they'll be reviewing, they're all quite similar. There's 11 of them, one about each school district. So we have the one about Duval County posted on our website if you want to read it. But it goes through sort of the history of when we implemented the mask mandate, what the commissioner has said, and how we've decided to continue with the mask mandate. And then after he lays this out in his memo, he asks the State Board of Education to withhold the school board member salaries and this federal grant money that they might get for each of these 11 districts. So he's laid out his requests pretty clearly. We don't quite know yet what the State Board of Education is going to do in response.
Okay, it's 549-2937. Let's take one more call. It's Gigi on the South Side. Gigi, good morning.
Good morning. My question is this, and I've just heard this for the first time. If there's billions of dollars that DeSantis can draw for schools, why aren't we ventilating the classroom, maybe putting air purifiers in the classrooms? Since as a state level, he won't allow masks. Well, then let's try to protect the kids' plexiglass on their desks. But I mean, there's a ventilation system that restaurants use, and it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, thank you for that, Gigi. You know, Claire, we're getting emails about this too. Here's one from a pediatrician, Dr. David Childers. He emails the show, the Department of Ed has not released the legislatively assigned funding for discretionary programs for kids with disabilities. They have an approved spending plan submitted in April. They withheld a large amount of money last fiscal year due to COVID. And so, you know, I think it's fair to say there is a lot of frustration about this among all kinds of different stakeholders. Why this money isn't being spent on COVID relief measures, helping kids with disabilities, all of the things the money's intended for.
Right. As both these listeners said, there's tons of uses for this money. The HVAC systems, that's something that came up this week during the school board meeting, that it would cost $6 to $8 million to update all the HVAC systems in the district. And that was one thing school board member Joyce referenced in voting against the vaccine incentive. She said, instead of doing the $200 checks towards vaccine incentives, why don't we put it towards the HVAC systems that would cost $6 to $8 million? But we also, there is this state money, and it does seem like it would be possible to access the federal money coming to the state to update our HVAC system and still be able to afford vaccine incentives.
We'll follow it. The State Board of Education meets today. Look for Claire's update on that at WJCT.org and on our newscast. Claire Heddles, always good to speak with you. Thanks.
Thanks, Melissa.
And much more still ahead. Later in the hour, how you can enjoy a taste of the Philippines downtown this weekend, but up next.
You know that more cases are being exposed in the press, but then you realize that they're still happening.
A conversation about gender-based violence with Anita Hill. Yes, that Anita Hill. We go inside the pages of her new book, Believing. That's after this.
WJCT Public Media is bringing you a new healthcare show, What's Health Got to Do with It? Our goal is to help you navigate all things health and healthcare and get you the answers you deserve. Join me, Dr. Joe Servin, Saturdays at 4 p.m. and Sundays at 9 p.m. on WJCT News 89.9. Sponsored in part by American Brain Foundation, Epilepsy Foundation, and Norellis.
He's back. Ron Clark returns to teach on Saturday, November 13th at the Hyatt Regency Jacksonville. Expect a heartfelt, inspirational, table-standing presentation from Ron and learn from the best local educators at this day-long conference. Visit wjct.org/teach for additional details and to get your tickets now.
Welcome back. Well, 30 years ago this fall, Anita Hill faced down an all-male, all-white Senate Judiciary Committee. It was led by then-Senator Joe Biden. And she testified that her boss, Supreme Court Justice nominee Clarence Thomas, had sexually harassed her. It was a landmark moment for these issues, and it inspired countless women to come forward with their stories, to file complaints, and even to run for office. Remember the Year of the Woman back then? Well, in the years since, our cultural understanding of sexual harassment as a societal scourge has grown. But unfortunately, too much remains the same. 19 million Me Too tweets showed that gender-based violence is ubiquitous, but real change remains elusive. So what happens next? In her powerful new book, Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender Violence, Anita Hill draws on her decades as a teacher and a legal scholar to explore the far-reaching impact of gender-based violence, why it persists, why it's systemic, and what we can do to change it. Believing is a strident call to arms from one of her most prominent and poised survivors. as she draws on lessons learned from the Thomas hearing in 1991, the Brett Kavanaugh hearings in 2018, and countless events in between and since. Anita Hill shows how far we have and haven't come in 30 years, and what should come in the next 30. I spoke with Anita Hill about her book, Believing. Here's that conversation. Anita Hill, it's a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
You know, with the release of your book, Believing, the subtitle is Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender Violence. The first thing I thought when I opened your book was, wow, it really has been 30 years since you testified during the hearings to confirm Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court. And, you know, in everything that's happened since that time, one takeaway I took from your book is that we've made progress, but then in so many ways we have not. Is that part of what motivated you to write this book?
Yeah, so you know, when you took a 30-year assessment, you know that in some ways the conversation has changed, the awareness has been raised to these issues. You know that more cases are being exposed in the press, but then you realize that they're still happening, that these behaviors are still occurring, and that people are still looking for solutions.
What was it like for you during the Kavanaugh hearings when you saw the testimony of Christine Blasey Ford? And as you write in the book, you later had the opportunity to connect with her. What was that like for you personally, since you had gone through much the same thing years in the past?
Well, our experiences are singular, but they do have that common denominator of sitting in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee and trying to explain to them not only what the behavior was that we experienced, but why it was important to their decision about an individual's character and fitness to sit on the Supreme Court. And so those were the things that were weighing on my mind. Is she going to be able to convince people of her experience? Is there going to be an investigation that will help her prove her claim? And are the senators on that committee going to understand that this is relevant information to their decision? And I came up really with both thinking that we'd missed another opportunity in both instances.
Yeah, of course, Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed. I found it fascinating to read in your book that Joe Biden, who was on the Senate Judiciary Committee when you testified, it, of course, he's now president, that he did call you and apologize to you for the way you were treated in the early 90s. But, you know, as I read your book, Anita, the big point I think people need to take from your experience and your research is that this is a systemic problem. And that when you write about gender violence, you're not just talking about physical violence. Can you explain what you mean by the totality of gender violence?
I'm talking about emotional violence and aggression. I'm talking about extortion. In some cases, there's economic aggression where women who are in intimate partner relationships are extorted from the money that they earn, for the money that they earn. I'm talking about sexual harassment that sometimes includes physical violence, groping, and such sexual assault, but also that includes verbal and emotional harassment that can occur in the workplace. So I'm talking about a range of behaviors and bullying among elementary schools. You know, I start really talking about how this behavior is, where it's located, with talking about what's going on in elementary schools and the fact that it's a problem that most people are not aware of, but that is happening in our schools today. In many cases, it's based on a child's gender identity or the way that they express their gender or sexual identity. And so these are all issues that all the behaviors that I'm trying to talk about, because they're the behaviors that have come to me through letters and recently emails, as well as phone calls, as connected to not only my experience, but to the experience of many others.
So in your book, Believing, you talk about this as being a systemic problem that requires systemic solutions. Can you share a little bit your insights about what you think, as a unique thought leader, really, in this space, what you think we could do as a country to better get at the roots of gender violence and make America a more even playing field for everyone?
Well, one of the myths that allows gender violence to occur is that we tell each other that gender violence is just a product of a few bad apples, and all we have to do is get rid of those few bad apples and the problem will be over. We tell people that, oh, it's not so bad, that the harm is not there. And what I say, the beginning of acknowledgement of the problem that as it really exists is acknowledging that it is cultural. It's built in our culture. And the way we respond, it keeps us from solving the problem. When we blame victims, when we immediately discredit and attack individuals who come forward, especially against powerful men. But we can't just stop with changing our cultural responses. We also have to change our systems, because our systems were mostly built during a time when we, in fact, believe those myths, and so those myths are built in and create enormous hurdles for individuals who have complaints to come forward and be heard.
And do you feel that the Me Too and Time's Up movements are at least getting us a little bit down the path of addressing these sorts of systemic structures?
The importance of the Me Too movement is enormous. In particular, all of the awareness raising that has occurred. But Me Too was enormous because we, even in 2017, we were telling people that the problem was minimal. And with the 19 million tweets and the stories that we came out of Me Too, we could no longer honestly believe the lie that the problem was minimal. And so I think that awareness raising, that sense of urgency that Me Too brought to us is a great energizing factor in how we can move forward. But we still have to change our system. We still have to change our own behavior. Not just the behavior of the individuals who are behaving badly, but how we, in fact, some ways, become complicit in their bad behavior. We've got to address that. But systems and processes have to be scrutinized. They have to be altered. And it starts with our leadership. Leadership at the top of any organization has the power and the responsibility to make those changes.
And then going beyond the culture and private companies, what do you think should be done on the policy side?
Well, there are policies and Washington policies. The Violence Against Women Act needs to be reaffirmed, and it needs to be strengthened. In terms of internal company policies, most companies don't have policies against what we call microaggressions and gender harassment, and even bullying. And what we do know is that these behaviors are sort of entry-level behaviors to more egregious behavior, including sexual assault, harassment, and extortion. And so I think if companies want to prevent the problem, that they need to develop policies that address those behaviors that now don't appear in their policies, that appear as lesser and unrelated, but are directly related to the policies that people file lawsuits behind.
Absolutely. And there's so much more in your book. I recommend it. It's really such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for your time. Anita Hill, her new book is Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender Violence. Pick it up today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, right now we want to update you about a bipartisan effort to keep Florida children out of what's come to be known as the school-to-prison pipeline. Now, several bills are going to be considered in the upcoming state legislative session. They would expunge the arrest records of children, children who have successfully completed diversion programs. Data shows this gives kids a much better chance at success as an adult. Carrie Boyd joins us now. She's policy director for the SPLC Action Fund. Hi, Carrie.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to join you today.
It's great to have you. So the school-to-prison pipeline is now commonly known as the unfortunate thing that happens when if a child or teen has any contact with the criminal justice system, the odds increase that they're going to continue to have contact with it, and they're going to get sidetracked from education and success in life. So what's encouraging is that there's legislation moving now that both parties support that would help with this, that would help children. How is this legislation structured? What would it do?
Well, thank you for having me once again. Yes, the school-to-prison pipeline is a huge problem here in Florida. Florida is the state in the country that leads in terms of children being charged either in juvenile court or as an adult for alleged offenses. And so the school-to-prison pipeline, as you've said, really is a process through which kids are pushed out of schools and into prisons. And so, in other words, it is criminalizing youth and carried out by disciplinary policies or contact with law enforcement. And what's really exciting about this year here in Florida is we have a package of bills that have been sponsored by Senator Keith Perry and Representative David Smith that would allow for juvenile diversion and records expunction for certain offenses. And so these diversion programs are terrific because they help keep kids out of the system and would allow them to avoid that stigma and having a conviction. And so we're very excited about this, and I look forward to discussing it with you all this morning.
Yeah. And what's remarkable, too, is there's very rarely bipartisan agreement on anything, but this is something most reasonable people can agree on. Can you talk about the education campaign over the years that's gotten us to this point?
Yes. So this bill package, this is actually its fourth year being run by Senator Perry. So he is a champion, and we really commend him for that. Your state attorney, Melissa Nelson, has really made diversion programs the centerpiece of her time in office, and we commend her for that as well. This legislation would take it a step further by expunging the arrest records of those who got into diversion programs. And so current law only allows for misdemeanor offenses to be diverted or expunged. And this package would allow for an expansion of that. It doesn't allow for crimes like murder or attempted murder or sexual offenses to be included, but it does allow a second chance for youth who may find themselves in a bad situation, they made a bad choice. And we're really excited about the prospect of keeping kids out of prisons and jails and helping them move on with life. The SPLC Action Fund, along with partners such as the Florida Juvenile Justice Association and our coalition, No Place for a Child, we've really worked on this for the past several years, and I commend all the great people on the ground who are helping spread awareness and educate our citizens about its impact.
So this isn't the first go-round with trying to get this kind of law passed in Florida. What are the challenges?
The challenges are, quite frankly, a lot of misunderstanding about what the law does and what it means. And you're correct. This bill passed the Florida House and Senate unanimously last year. So that means in your area, you know, Representative Cord Byrd, Tracy Davis, Senator Aaron Bean, Audrey Gibson, Jennifer Bradley, Angie Nixon, all of these folks voted for it. It is a bipartisan bill. The challenge, I believe, is misunderstandings, as I said. Governor DeSantis vetoed it. It was one of five bills he vetoed. He was concerned about it being applied to forcible offenses such as murder, sexual crime. So the bill has been amended to account for his concern. And this year, we believe we have taken this above and beyond what the concerns are and that it should pass again unanimously. And we're very hopeful that this time around, the governor and his team will support this great bill.
How many other states have done this kind of legislation?
So across the country, there are over two dozen states that have cemented diversion and expunction programs as part of state law. And it really can be a program or a resource that is dependent on a county-by-county or jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction approach. So even if there aren't state laws in place that command it or offer it, individual state attorneys and police departments, you know, they can have diversion programs in place to offer these resources to kids. And it does take a lot of collaboration with social service providers, law enforcement, state attorney's office, but, you know, the end justifies the means. You know, we need to keep kids out of prison, out of jails, and this bill package will divert approximately 27,000 Florida children a year from the system. So it's an extraordinary piece of legislation. Mm-hmm. We feel it is one of the greatest workforce development bill packages in the last decade because these children will go into adulthood free of a conviction, free of the stigma. They'll be able to go to college, join the military, get housing, get student loans, get a car loan, all these great things that we need to have the full force and effect of citizens and have the right to vote. So it's very exciting to us, and we really, really are looking forward to this session and working on this bill package.
We'll follow it. Thank you, Carrie. She's Carrie Boyd, Policy Director for the SPLC Action Fund. Lots going to be happening in the upcoming legislative session. We'll follow the progress of this. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
A quick break, and in a moment, did you know that Jacksonville has one of the largest Filipino-American communities in the country? You can enjoy a taste of this vibrant local culture coming up this weekend with a taste of the Philippines. We'll have a preview of all the fun in just a few minutes. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9.
Listening and delivering personalized plans from a team of specialists dedicated to providing the latest technology and treatment at every step. Get the care you need at ascension.org. Congarean Pin, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpin.com. He's back. Ron Clark returns to teach on Saturday, November 13th at the Hyatt Regency Jacksonville. Expect a heartfelt, inspirational, table-standing presentation from Ron, and learn from the best local educators at this day-long conference. Visit wjct.org/teach for additional details and to get your tickets now.
On the next Fresh Air, life in Afghanistan today, now that the Taliban are in power. Reporter Najibullah Qureshi will join us from Kabul, where he has been talking to the Taliban as well as to people who fear them. He's the correspondent on a new PBS Frontline documentary about the Taliban takeover and the growing threat from Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Years before he ran one of the world's biggest companies, Paul Polman considered becoming a priest. He stepped down as Unilever's CEO in 2019 and now preaches a green gospel.
Do we really care? I wonder. I wonder if we have enough people that really care.
We'll ask him how many of them are now among the faithful, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, Jacksonville has a large and vibrant Filipino community, one of the largest around. And this weekend, you can get a taste of the Philippines at a special event. Commercial photographer Agnes Lopez grew up in this community. She's on the line to give us a preview. Hey, Agnes.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, and it's good to hear your voice. So tell us a little bit about a taste of the Philippines. It's coming up at the Mosh.
Yes, it is this evening.
It's tonight. We have, I misspoke. Thank you. Yes.
Yes, it is this evening. We have a few tickets left, so get them soon. But we will have several different food vendors serving up different foods, probably some that you've never tasted before, such as Abstract Filipino Essence. We've got Perfect Pear, Christina Jacks, and many more. We also have a secret tiki temple and sponsored by Tendwai Rum, serving up some Filipino-inspired cocktails that will be sold at the event. And we have a pop-up art exhibit with local artists, Filipino artists, as well as guest speaker Jeffrey Manuel tonight.
Including some artwork and some of your newest work that will be exhibited.
Yes.
Tell us about the Pinay Project.
Yes, the Pinay Project
Pinay.
Is... Yes,
can I? I'm batting 1,000 today, aren't I?
No worries. That all started because I wanted to see more Filipino artists like me out there, and you know, I looked around and I didn't. So I searched all over the community and started this photo series project of these strong women in the community who are producing art, and so I have the took their portraits and. Have them, they will be displayed, and they're all local artists. And my main thing is I wanted to see people, in my portfolio, I noticed I didn't have many people that look like me, so I started that project, and that kind of spurred the art exhibit tonight, and several of them that I photographed will be exhibiting. And we're all very excited, and I'm excited to see what they've all created.
Now, let's talk, if we could, about the vibrancy of this community in Jacksonville. People might not realize what a large Filipino-American community we have here.
Yes, we are, I believe, the largest in the Southeast. Whenever I say that, everyone's so surprised. We are all over Jacksonville, and I think a lot of people don't realize it is because, you know, sometimes we're hidden. And that is one of the reasons we started doing this event. This is our fourth annual event, and we wanted to let people know that we're here in the community, and we want to share with you guys and welcome you into learning more about who we are.
What was it like growing up Filipino-American for you in Jacksonville?
Oh, that is a good question. Growing up in Jacksonville, I always thought of myself as an American, honestly. I'm born and raised in Jacksonville, and I really didn't start connecting with my Filipino side until I got older. and I've learned so much. Specifically, this October is Filipino American history, and I have learned so much of how we are such a huge part of the American history. There's so much Filipino American history that happened here that I was not taught, and I am just now so fascinated and immersed in this and in constantly learning. So.
And people can learn more when they come out to the mosh tonight. This is a family-friendly event, although you will be serving alcoholic beverages. You want to people to bring the whole family.
Yes, we do. It is a family-friendly event, and you have access to the entire Mosh Museum, which I believe they have a new exhibit, the Da Vinci exhibit, that you can also explore as well. So it's definitely a great event, and you will definitely learn a lot. All the chefs, I think they have like this special kind of QR code where they will explain the dishes, and some of them may even have the recipes that you can learn about, where the origins are from, and you know, learn a little bit more detail instead of just, you know, you trying out food and not knowing, you know, what's in it, where it came from, what the origin is. So.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. People might realize we have a large Filipino American community when they drive past the Jollibee restaurant at Atlantic and Kernan Boulevards. That place wouldn't be there if we didn't have a large Filipino American community. That's a big Filipino chain. But for folks listening to this, this is an opportunity to come and sample not fast food, but gourmet Filipino cuisine tonight, made by local chefs, and check out the art of local Filipino American residents, including Agnes's work, which is so transformative and amazing. And I'm always such a fan of your work. So come on out tonight. Our doors open at 6 o'clock at the Mosh, the Museum of Science and History, hosting the 4th annual A Taste of the Philippines. Enjoy pop-up art, food, and cocktails, and a panel discussion, creative conversations with Filipino-American artists of Jacksonville in the Brian Gooding Planetarium, tastings by local chefs, and more. It sounds amazing, Agnes. Agnes Lopez, a talented commercial photographer. Thanks so much. Have fun.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day, everyone. Be safe out there.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.